Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
I want to do two more pieces of transhumanism, and I think the second one will lead us pretty well into the Mormon section. So let's see if this works. All right, we talked about the singularity, we talked about AI, artificial intelligence, and things like that. Tyson, when you gave your definition of the singularity, you focused a little bit more on human enhancement. There's this concept in transhumanism. And it's, again, it's another piece of the word transhumanism, Lincoln, that you could have focused on, and that is the idea of becoming post-human. And a transhumanist or a transhuman person is somebody who is living that journey consciously, right?
Yep.
towards this next evolutionary step. And so if you guys are comfortable introducing the term post-human as a piece, I think a lot of our listeners will be able to draw, you know, in their heads as a tie to Mormonism. And then after this, I want to do just a little bit with the simulation argument and stuff. So those will be my two areas. So I'll just turn it over to you guys.
So with post-human, the idea with a post-human would be that we are continuing to evolve. Humanity is continuing to evolve. Because of technology, we have this opportunity to take control of our evolution, at least to a substantial extent, if not entirely. And at some point, assuming that we continue to survive and continue to evolve, we will be as different from current humanity is from our pre-human ancestors. So there was a time when humans were not humans from a scientific perspective, right? We were I don't know, I'm not going to throw the scientific names for them out there because I'll get them wrong.
The guys before Homo sapiens, the guys with smaller brains, especially.
That's right. So at one point in our evolutionary history, we were not humans. Our ancestors were not humans. Now we are humans, and there will be a time, assuming we survive long enough, that we will no longer be humans in the sense that we are now human. Now, what could that mean? That could be, as we've discussed, that could be something horrible. Our future could be terrible. Maybe we don't destroy ourselves. Maybe we devolve into, I don't know, you just use your imagination, watch some dystopian sci-fi movie, and you can come up with plenty of negative scenarios. But there also may be some very positive, flourishing scenarios where we're able to use our increasing knowledge and our increasing power through technology, through science, through art, through politics, through religion, to become more creative, to become more compassionate. In fact, creative and compassionate beyond present human capacities, to the point that if we were to see such post-humans now, given our current human capacities, we would perceive them as God, as gods. That, I think, is a Mormon transhumanist perspective on post-humanity.
Okay, but within Mormon theology a little bit, this idea that we're here in this process of God-making, you know, this idea of you know, transforming ourselves more into like a godlike character, that really, when Lincoln said earlier, Mormonism is transhumanism, I like that idea with that definition of transhumanist, someone who is actively in the process of, you know, anticipating this future that, you know, we'll call it godhood, we'll call it, you know, godly, divine nature, with divine capacities, etc., right? So
yeah, and there's a parallel here, not only on, so there's an even stronger parallel, I think, with our theology. in Mormonism, even in Christianity, we have this idea from the Bible of Satan aspiring to godhood, of an egotistical sort. And we also have this idea of Jesus representing a godhood of an altruistic sort. Satan is described as raising himself above all else that is called God, declaring himself God. Jesus is described by Paul in the New Testament as being that God that would have us be joint heirs in the glory of God, with the qualification, if so be that we would suffer with him. That might get us into a discussion of atonement later. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so I think we see those same possibilities in post-humanity. We have the possibility of aiming our technological abilities, our politics and our art and our religion at becoming egotistical, dangerous, uncooperative, whatever other negative potential scenarios you can imagine, and associate that with this negative post-humanity. And then we also have the opportunity of directing ourselves towards this positive, flourishing, cooperative, compassionate, and creative post-humanity that we would associate with becoming more like Christ.
Lincoln, what have been some of the challenges you've had incorporating these Mormon concepts into the transhuman conversations with these other transhumanists?
By and large, the biggest challenge is getting enough time and enough easing of prejudices for them to listen. Once they listen, my experience has been very positive with almost all transhumanists. They like what we're doing, very supportive.
But I'm thinking from somebody that you would be introduced to at a conference, and you were able to go to dinner with them, explain your position, and they might seem to accept your general approach that you take. It's just another approach to transhumanism. I'm role playing here a bit.
Yeah.
But only from a if you're speaking allegorical from a biblical perspective, and not from a literal perspective, that there will literally be a resurrection of a Jesus, or that there literally was a global deluge, and these things happened via supernatural means and methods. So from an enlightened Mormon allegorical approach, I could see being not in opposition, but if you were to take these ideas and bring them to the table as this is going to define transhumanism, would you not have some intellectual challenges from these individuals with respect to even from an allegorical perspective?
Yeah, and I'll let Chris jump in on this in just one second, but let me just say first of all that Mormonism, you know, even the LDS Church doesn't hold to a strictly literal interpretation of Scripture. And then on the opposite end of the spectrum, there are more transhumanists than you might initially imagine who are very open to the idea of a literal resurrection, just as one example, and other similar very literal future possibilities. So, Chris, I'm going to let you jump in and answer a little bit more on that while I grab a quick drink.
Oh, Chris, you're still there. Oh, good.
I
can understand from there's a little bit of uncertainty there with respect to the resurrection question. So when you watch Ray Kurzweil's Transcendent Man, and he talks about trying to restore the consciousness of his father, I think if I'm remembering correctly,
yeah,
that type of resurrection is different than I think there's a lot more literalness in religion than we're agreeing to here. The global deluge is taught in Sunday school, and the Tower of Babel is central to the historicity of the Book of Mormon. So there are some things that do tie us down, and I'm not seeing that bridge in the argument, at least, between that more conservative approach to the more liberal approach.
So I think there are a couple of ways to talk about this. One is that while you certainly have a very literalistic strain in Mormonism, I also think that you have a less literalistic strain. And you can find a lot of this actually in early discourses. In, you know, when you go back and look at the Journal of Discourses, for example, there was a lot less of a tendency toward literalism in many respects in Mormonism. And so I think, you know, we can draw on some of that tradition. Now, having said that, there's another piece here, and I know this is something that Dan was also interested in on the transhumanist side, and that is this idea of the simulation argument. And the simulation argument is a fairly technical, philosophical argument that was put forward by Nick Bostrom, who you mentioned a little bit earlier. And basically, he gives probabilistic reasons that one of three possible scenarios must be true. And these three, and there are three mutually exclusive scenarios. And they are either one, that humanity will never have the ability to create simulations that are detailed enough that they're indistinguishable from reality and would simulate ancestors or, you know, worlds of people that are as detailed as our world. So either we will not ever get that capacity, or we will have the capacity, but for other reasons, whether they're economic reasons or whatever other reasons, we never actually do that, even though we have the capability. Or three, we have that capability, and so many of these simulated worlds are created that, statistically speaking, we are most likely living in such a simulation. And so, you know, he goes into all of the philosophy behind this, but essentially the conclusion is one of these three things must be true. And a group of us in the MTA developed what we call the New God argument. And basically what we establish is that from a faith perspective, that is the perspective that humanity will not go extinct and we will gain the power to be creators of worlds. And given the faith in that perspective, the conclusion that we should reach is that we are living in a world that was created by beings who are very, very powerful and benevolent. And so just as a technical point, you know, Lincoln reached out to Nick Bostrom in discussing the simulation argument and established that this argument applies for many different forms of creation, that it's not simply simulation in the way that we think of like The Sims or a computer game or something that we would normally call fake, but we're talking about many possible different ways of creating worlds, that if humanity ever gets to a point where we create lots of worlds, then chances are probabilistically that we're in such a created world ourselves, which means that the likelihood is not only that we're striving to become God, but that God already exists as a benevolent creator. And what this does is it actually opens the door to some things that would otherwise seem outlandish or fantastical from a scientific perspective. They actually open the door for some literal readings, at least being open to some literal readings of scriptural stories. Now, that's not to say that it, you know, it's warranted to always believe in a literal interpretation. It's just to say that it may not be as far-fetched as it might initially appear once we take into account this kind of an argument and this kind of an idea.
A couple of fun things about that. I think that was an episode in Star Trek where they had a character that entered into that type of simulated world. I like it's fun to point out the places where
the feedback loop.
Yeah. Pop culture has incorporated that. I also recall this as being one of the. So I'm a Sam Harris fan, but I recall one of his blogs concluding with the idea that we are, that the possibility exists that we are living inside one of these Mormon simulations. And
that's
and,
right. He did blog on it. The title was "Are We Mormons in the Matrix?"
Yes. Google precisely. That. Yeah, and in listening to Chris and Lincoln discuss these things, I recognize how our minds are limited by our inability to instinctively grasp large numbers, large concepts, and
yeah.
And I think that's something that's challenging for all of us. But then I also try to at least think of the possibilities of these all occurring. And I see from Chris and Lincoln's perspective, well, I look at their perspective and I think that there's a very low probability of what they're proposing as opposed to some other theories within physics. And then based on the evidence that we have with respect to the origin of life on the planet that you know we're currently experiencing, we hope at least we're experiencing. So I think the challenge is there's not enough evidence for to convince me at the moment that I need to get back into the water. So to speak.
So one of the interesting things to point out about the simulation argument, but more particularly what we call the new God argument, is that it's not a proof or an argument for the existence of God. The new God argument is a moral argument or a practical argument that we should trust in the existence of God, God being understood as post-humanity, benevolent and creative. And this stems from an important position, an important assumption that we call the faith assumption. And Chris talked about that just briefly, but I want to hit on it one more time. And that is this idea that we don't know what the future of humanity will be, but we have both moral and practical reasons to trust in human flourishing, because it may be that trust itself is essential to attaining that flourishing. You know, this is a very pragmatic argument. And so we call this the faith assumption. And the faith assumption, don't confuse it with assuming our conclusion that God already exists. The faith assumption is faith in the post-human potential of humanity, and that potential is a positive one. And the interesting thing about this is that is at the heart of secular transhumanism. That's what transhumanism is about, and they wouldn't call it faith, but they would still look at it in this practical way that there is something. They wouldn't be talking about it so much if there wasn't something they felt like, something we felt like we could do to make it more likely to attain a future of human flourishing, a positive post-human future. And so based on that assumption, there is a rigorous, formal, logical argument that we call the new God argument that stems from that assumption, uses the simulation argument, and uses some other transhumanist and scientific and logical arguments forwarded by world-class scholars. It pulls these arguments together, uses the faith assumption to negate some of the possible logical disjuncts in these other arguments that are pulled in, and the conclusion, given some premises that some assumptions that people can debate, the conclusion is that we have a moral obligation to trust that God, or some people aren't comfortable calling this God because it's not necessarily the traditional notion of God. It's this post-human, creative, compassionate being or beings, that this kind of God exists, probably almost certainly created our world, and is more benevolent, more compassionate than we are. And I won't get into all the details of the argument because it is quite technical, but I for those who are interested in delving into the logic of the argument, looking at the assumptions, seeing where those assumptions come from, all the assumptions come from secular sources. You can go and you can look at it and assess it for yourself, and I hope people will. The website where we have the argument laid out is called newgodargument.com. Just type that in, newgodargument.com, in your web browser, and it'll take you to it. And you can see what the formal argument is, what the assumptions are, where they come from, and see for yourself. But again, I want to stress that it's not an argument for the existence of God. It's an argument for faith, for trust that God exists, because that trust in God's present almost certainly is our future, probabilistically speaking, or our future correlates with God's present. That's basically what the argument gets down to, is this practical recognition of the correlation between the two.
Does not therefore follow that the probability of such an event is increasingly less so, because we've got the probability of that we're in a simulation, the probability of that God exists, the probability that God loves us. So we're adding multiple probabilities upon each other, and they become even less and less probable in these circumstances.
Not exactly. I'd encourage you to look at the argument. There are three separate parts of the argument that don't depend on each other. There's one part of the argument called the creation argument, which builds on the simulation argument, but adds in a broader scope. Chris alluded to it, that we worked with Nick Bostrom to make sure we weren't misusing the simulation argument when we broadened it. Anyway, that's one part of the argument. There's a part of the argument called the benevolence argument, which stands completely independent of the creation argument, so there's not a multiplication of probabilities here. And there's also a part of the argument called the angel argument, which gets more deeply into the practical and moral driver for assuming that posthumans exist now, because if they don't, we are almost certainly destined for extinction, basically, is the heart of that argument. And it stands probabilistically independent of the other two parts, so we actually don't have these probabilities multiplying against each other. They're standing independent. And then when you reach the conclusions are actually three separate propositions that we just kind of and together using formal logic. Take a look at it. Again, it's technical, and I don't want to get into all the technical details and bore everybody right now.
Thank you. No, just teasing. Yeah. No, it's terrific. I've looked at it, and I was impressed with how it works. Tyson, I'm tempted, so let me just do this, and then we may or may not keep this. You mentioned earlier that, you know, no one's really trying to get you back into the water, but the idea that you thought that there were other realities more probable than what these guys were putting it. Do you want to share what you think are the more highly probable scenarios about what human life is and what the universe is?
That I think are more probable, or that I think other scientists...
Yeah, well, whatever. You basically are saying, you know, you're not leaning in the direction that these guys are, given, you know, the current circumstance, and I'm just curious, which directions do you lean in that you sense? You're not going to say that these guys' stuff is irrelevant to any possible future, right?
No, of course
right,
not.
So,
no,
it's
that there's a possibility. I do my best to try and learn about my mind so that I can avoid being wrong, and I think if I'm going to be intellectually honest, when I come across an argument or evidence that is more persuasive than the current my current position, I need to adopt that. Right. So that being said, I don't want to have an argument from authority, but there are some limitations on our understanding as how we view the world. We're Newtonian, and we don't understand a lot of what goes on quantum levels. But we know when you take somebody like Deepak Chopra and line him up against somebody like Leonard Mlodinow, now one person is speaking from a position of knowledge, and the other one is speaking from a position of speculation.
Sure.
Not knowledge. Mlodinow is speaking from a position of education and research and evidence and logic and reason, and those things are not always observed when it comes to Chopra's position. So,
well, but there's also the objective versus the subjective. He's much more in a mode that mines the insides rather than the outsides.
So, I'm going to rely upon the experts, a lot of the evidence that they're bringing to the table and they're interpreting, and then keep an open mind. So when I look at my understanding of the where we all came from, based upon the evidence that we see in the fossil record and from cosmology and of astrophysics, going back to the origin and the work that they're doing over at was it CERN that they're doing the work? Trying to identify the Bose-Higgson, is that right?
Higgs boson. Yep.
Yeah. Spoonerism there. So that, I'm gonna say that, you know, my understanding currently is that the more commonly accepted position from the scientific community is the most probable. Until I can be presented with better arguments and better evidence to change my position, I'm gonna continue to follow that.
That's reasonable. Let me say a few things about that. First of all, everything you listed out as things that you respect as informing your view of origins, I share all of those. The New God argument is perfectly compatible with evolution and cosmology as understood contemporarily. That's the first thing I wanted to say is I hope nobody should understand what I've said about the New God argument to be like an argument for what some people call creationism or what is popularly known as intelligent design. It's not an argument for those kinds of things. It's an argument that's that stems from contemporary science and technological trends. So that's the first thing. The second thing I wanted to do is maybe interject a little bit about myself at this point. And I'm doing it to put a personal to add maybe another reason for taking seriously the New God argument and things like it that we've been talking about. In my late teenage years, I started to have a kind of a crisis, a philosophical crisis. It's all really melodramatic for people who think that philosophy is kind of a waste of time. But for me, it was actually really quite serious, and I started to lose. One of the effects of it, there were others, but one of the effects of it was that I started to lose my faith in what I understood of God as a child. And I think most people go through that to some extent, but for me it was quite serious. And I know, and that might be the kind of people that tend to go into philosophy. Dan, I think you may have experienced something like that. And Tyson, I'm sure you experienced something like that as you were transitioning from Mormonism to atheism. But not everybody goes through it. I started going through a period like that. And I never ended up identifying as an atheist, but I did get to a point in my worldview where I described my faith in God mostly in panentheistic terms, but the most interesting and maybe humorous part about my view of God during that period of time was that I would tell people that I was agnostic relative to extraterrestrial humanoid deities. I wanted to be clear to them that although I still identified as a form of theist, I didn't know if God was so much out there as God was in here. God was imminent. That part always resonated with me. And we should continue to flourish and develop that God in us, the Christ in us, as Paul in the New Testament puts it. That was still very important to me. But I wasn't so sure God was out there. I had spiritual experiences, and those were, and we could talk forever about, you know, how I processed those. But during this period of time, not even they were enough to really give me confidence that God was out there. Long story short, the New God argument is something that kind of formulated over a period of years, but the process of formulating that argument persuaded me to change my mind, where I had already gotten into I was comfortable in my life with just acknowledging to people, you know what? I'm agnostic about this extraterrestrial humanoid deity. The new God argument changed me. And I identify now as, you know, I'm still a theist. I'm still a panentheist. I still look at this. I still feel this and care about this immanent God. But I am fully persuaded that there is this transcendent out there God too. It has completely transformed my worldview back to be much more like it was actually when I was a child, but there's some important differences too. Things are never exactly how they started. But it's been a very persuasive thing for me. It's changed my worldview a lot and Chris can attest to this. Chris has known me during this period of time, and he's probably kind of laughed to himself as he's watched that change happen, because I would at times, you know, with some people be my nature as being trained in philosophy, I'd like to get into rigorous arguments with people trying to, you know, why do you trust in this extraterrestrial humanoid deity? Give me reasons. And, you know, we would argue about it, you know, good-naturedly for the most part, I hope. But then this shift happened where these people that I used to argue about this with, now one of them being Chris's brother-in-law, Carl Hale, now we laugh together and say, yep, now I do trust in the I have faith in this extraterrestrial humanoid deity.
And that's what Carl's going to be speaking about at the conference, is extraterrestrial humanoid deity. So a reference back to that, it'll be fun.
Yeah.
Well, good. One of the last things that I want to do in this podcast, I want to give our listeners a flavor for how certain terms in Christianity, in Mormonism, sort of get a new life. And this is really one of my favorite things about talking with you guys, is with this broader transhumanist, this future, this really thinking about active faith in concepts and, you know, shaping our future and shaping ourselves and evolution, all that stuff. It gives a lot of new life to certain terms. So if you guys don't mind, I think I'll just go to Chris. Do you mind, like, picking a concept or two that, I don't know, I'll tell you two from me. From last night, I really enjoyed our conversation about becoming a Christ and atonement. Would you mind just, like, giving a flavor on those? And then, Lincoln, you can jump in however you want. And Tyson, sure. please ask questions.
Sure. Hey, you know, so one of the big questions that often comes up when we talk about transhumanism and religion, and in particular Mormonism, is the question of, you know, well, what does sort of the basic gospel of faith and repentance and atonement and Jesus, what do they have to do with all of this stuff, right? I mean, it doesn't seem like there's a strong connection there. But I think that you know, as we start to look at the possibilities of the future, as humans increase in power and knowledge, we run up against the question of what kinds of beings are we going to be? Are we going to be the kinds of beings who are egotistical, selfish, who are, you know, use power for their own gain? Or are we going to be the kinds of beings who use power and knowledge in an altruistic way, in a charitable way? And archetypically, these are really represented as, are we going to be like Satan, or are we going to be like Christ?
Good, good.
And so, you know, I really do think that there is a strong connection, because when we talk about sort of having this active faith in the future potential of humanity, what we're really talking about is acting in a way that drives us to be more like Christ.
Today, not just tomorrow.
Right. That this is not, it's not something that is just somehow going to happen to us. And this is actually an area where I think Mormonism does an exemplary job in our understanding of what it means to become like Christ, is that it's not something that magically happens, but it's something that we should be working toward, not simply as individuals, but also as a community. And this is also where atonement comes in. You know, I'm sure your listeners are aware that you know, the English word atonement really is composed of those parts that somehow sound silly when you talk about it this way, but the idea of at-one-ment.
Yeah, it was a word that was introduced by the King James translators, right? They made it up in order to get to that concept. Yeah,
that's right. This is the idea of reconciliation is another similar term that's used, you know, that the translators use to describe what Jesus is talking about in his teachings. And it's this idea of oneness that we see in his intercessory prayer, that those who follow him may be one as he and the Father are one. And this oneness that he's describing is the oneness that we associate with the Godhead, right? And this is what they are inviting us to participate in, is to join them in their work and their glory, right? To bring to pass the immortality and eternal life of man. And that this is not only their work, but it's ours. Christ has said, come, follow me, do the works that you have seen me do. Even at one point, he tells his disciples that those who follow him will do greater works than those that they have seen him do. And not in a self-aggrandizing sense at all, but in the sense that together and building on the foundations that he established, that we can move beyond even the things that we see him do. And so there's this really important idea that we need to, in a very comprehensive way, take upon ourselves the name of Christ. And that means taking on the characteristics of Christ. And this also means that we understand Christ not to be exclusive to Jesus, that Jesus is an exemplar or even maybe the exemplar of what it is to be Christ, but that he calls us all to take that same role. And you know, we use the term in Mormonism of being saviors on Mount Zion, and nowadays, we mostly associate that with doing proxy work for our dead ancestors. But again, if you look back at some of the early discourses of Mormon leaders, you see that this concept is actually much more expansive, that it actually is acting as Christ's to bring people together, to reconcile us to each other, and to participate in this at-one-ment with each other and then eventually with God as we become like he is. And we are created in his image. We have the potential to be like him. And this takes on a very interesting sense as you start to look at what the future potential of humanity is and where we are placing our faith.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. Lincoln, add anything you want there. Throw in a little King Follett, if you don't mind. You know, just some of that Joseph Smith language that at least guys like me really enjoy. And, you know, take atonement in Christ and add a little bit of layer there, if you don't mind.
Yeah, so... you know, you mentioned the King Follett thing. I've actually been working on a paper where I'm doing an interpretive variation of the King Follett sermon, recontextualized into a more modern setting, right? More modern understanding, incorporating transhumanist ideas, incorporating modern science and technological ideas. And, you know, one of the things that I point out there in this reinterpretation, this interpretive variation on the sermon, is I draw attention to how we can understand the great commandments that Jesus gave us in the New Testament. Right? He said in the New Testament, we read the first commandment is to love God. Well, in terms of transhumanism and Mormon transhumanism, the first commandment then would be to love post-humanity with all your hearts. And then the second commandment would be like it. It would be to love your neighbor or love your friends, love others as you love yourself, but love them not for what they are now, but love the post-humanity in them. And in taking this, you know, right to the King Follett discourse, where Joseph Smith, he's talking about, you know, we must learn to be gods ourselves, and he goes on and he talks about God, and he says, he basically says that God was once as you are now and is an exalted man, right? That's how he phrased it. Well, right. I would say another way of phrasing that is that God is once as you are now and is a post-human. Just tying this to these ideas of evolution, of humanity becoming post-humanity, that's really, so far as I'm concerned, at the heart of what Joseph Smith was doing in the King Follett discourse. Of course, he's taking it a step further. He's talking on the subject of the dead, and he's trying to help people understand how his theology relates to the resurrection.
Right.
And you know, we won't get into all the details now. Maybe you can read my paper if I end up getting it published. But Joseph Smith was a transhumanist, not in name. He didn't identify as a transhumanist, but Joseph Smith's theology was one of humanity becoming God, and not right. just any God, but the God that was once like us, right? The God that was exemplified by Jesus, the God that we were invited to be following the example of Jesus, of being one with this God.
And I think while Lincoln is casting this, you know, in modern transhumanist terms, when we're talking about loving post-humanity and loving the post-humanity in the humanity around us, I think one of the other key things that we recognize is that we can use religious language or we can use scientific language to describe the same kinds of concepts. And so this allows us to share concepts across aesthetic boundaries, across boundaries of vocabulary. And this is, I think, very meaningful, because now when we start to hear things like love your neighbor and love God and become like Christ and take his name upon you and so forth, that it adds, again, this sense of compatibility with the modern situation. And this, I think, is where, again, Joseph Smith's vision of a united human family and, you know, Mormonism growing up in the Enlightenment era really allows Mormonism to act as that bridge, as that glue and that common ground. And this is what, you know, really inspires me so much. Joseph Smith's thinking and his teachings about our potential and how we need to act toward each other to achieve that potential resonate with me more than any other thinker, any other religious thinker that I have encountered, and I've done a lot of study, and this is really what inspires me so greatly.
Very cool.
You know, I'd throw in there, I agree with Chris that Joseph Smith, particularly, you know, as his understanding, as his perspective on God evolved and developed towards the end of his life, I agree that's one of the most inspiring examples or inspiring theologies that I can think of. Another one for me that's very important is Paul of Tarsus, you know, the St. Paul from the New Testament. Paul, the writings of Paul converted me to be a Christian. You know, I grew up, I was always a Mormon in the sense that I could, it made sense to me that we should become like God. That just always made sense to me. But I couldn't get my head wrapped around like the idea of the atonement as it was explained to me as a child. It just seemed mysterious and inapplicable.
Exactly, yeah.
But the person who helped me start to understand it in a more practical way was Paul, as I really dug into the writings in the New Testament. And as I've done that, I've started to appreciate why Paul was so influential as an early Christian. Because, you know, reading that stuff, you know, I don't agree with every single thing that Paul says. There's some stuff in there where I kind of roll my eyes when, you know, women not speaking in church or whatever. But by and large, the stuff that I read is very inspiring, particularly when he starts talking about Christ. You know, one of my favorite passages from Paul is when he's talking about the great mystery hid from ages is Christ in you. And he goes on to talk about how Paul, he himself, is filling up that which is behind of the afflictions of Christ. You know, that which is still yet to be done in the atonement in Paul's own flesh for the church. You know, there's more work to be done. There's more suffering to heal. There's more you know, mental anguish to console. We are all called to this work. And Paul persuaded me of the importance and the value of reaching out to other people and seeking this reconciliation. And this ties into transhumanism in very important ways, because we are today relatively limited in our abilities to console and heal others. But our abilities to do these things have been improving. And one of the important contributors, not the only, but one of the important contributors to that, and maybe one of the best contributors, is technology and our scientific understanding of the world. We can now heal each other in ways we couldn't do before. And I think I look at this, I look at science as inspired knowledge from God, and I look at technology as an endowment of power from God that we should learn to use with compassion and to heal and console others. For me, that is a major driving factor in my transhumanism, in my Mormon transhumanism, is that I am called to be Christ. Jesus gave me this call. I felt it deeply. Even when I didn't trust that the extraterrestrial humanoid deity was out there, I still felt this drive of this calling to be a disciple of Christ in me. And I saw it in others, and I saw how it affected other people's lives. And I saw that technology was one of the ways that we were able to do this even better. Now, I'd appeal to other things too. I think that we're progressing in our ability to use politics and art to bring each other together and reconcile as well. And I think all of these things can work together. Some people think that these things are combating religion. They're opposition, right, or alternatives to religion. I don't agree. I see God as working in all of this, manifest in all of this, you know, in the same way that our environment is shaping our biological evolution, I would say that it's also shaping our mimetic evolution, our spiritual evolution, if you will. We are becoming more like God. We are learning to be gods ourselves, as Joseph would put it, in all of these different ways. And technology is empowering to us to do this, to console and heal each other better than ever before, if we'll choose to use it that way.
Right. And this is another area that where I think Mormonism, in its sort of ideal or foundational sense, has an advantage over many other faiths, because while we all have this strong tendency toward an exclusivist authority position in the church, we also have the tradition of, you know, Mormonism is receiving truth wherever the source may come from and recognizing the hand of God in all kinds of different things. And you have wonderful sermons from, you know, presidents of the church acknowledging the miracles of science and recognizing God's hand in technology that can, you know, bring the gospel to the world and so forth. And I think Mormonism is very open to those kinds of things.
Good. Tyson, I'm guessing that other than using the language of Christ, you probably feel that same call that Lincoln's talking about, to heal others and to reach out and to reconcile and all that. Or does what they say steer in a fundamentally dangerous or wrong way?
Well, I don't want to rain on the parade, and that's what I feel like I'd be doing if I voiced some of my opinions on the matter. However, I think the common ground that we share is the reduction of suffering and the increase of happiness for humanity, and where there's common ground, I don't see any reason why we shouldn't share that common ground.
But you would have hesitations that the language takes you in the wrong direction, or it's got too much baggage. Just get new language.
No. I don't mind the language. It's language made by humanity to help define and express emotions, experiences, feelings that we didn't have as good of an understanding as we do now. I think the delivery system for these humanistic principles, well, one, that they can be tested, and we can and we should be adopting, and I see this happening with the transhuman movement, is that they're more quickly adopting these delivery systems for more humanistic approaches to life, faster than certainly religious dogmas. I also would bring out that there's a really fun analogy that's been blogged about by Sam Harris called the fireplace delusion, which is it's a good challenge to the position that we can achieve these humanistic principles or these humanistic results through the vehicle of religious tenets or religious institutions. But I mean, those are arguments that I don't know that they're necessary to debate.
And you know what? I would actually probably agree with them largely, except to the extent where I would bet that they're usually posited without acknowledging the ability and actually the evidence for the evolution of religion, right? Religion has evolved for thousands and thousands of years. It's still evolving now. And so to say that it's applicable, less applicable now perhaps than it was in the past, I think is overlooking some of the ways that religion is already changing.
I also would my experience is that most of the arguments, particularly in the new atheist movement, are arguments against a God that is somewhat foreign to Mormon concepts of God.
Absolutely.
And that, so while, yes, there are arguments out there, you know, against religious interpretations or uses of religious language and so forth, I think most of those are not addressing the kind of God that Mormonism embraces, and therefore those arguments really don't carry nearly as much weight. And I think that's another important thing, is that Mormonism embraces a naturalism in a way that most other Christian religions don't, and that this gives it a much stronger position in light of the new atheist arguments against religion. And I think that's important.
I'll add in Tyson's defense that very often in Mormonism, in popular Mormonism, God is expressed along the more mainstream lines. It happens regularly. I don't think it's the most robust or authentic expression of the God taught in Mormonism, but it does happen. And I'll also agree with Tyson that when we're not careful to try and express how what we're talking about is not only similar, but also different from those more mainstream notions of God, that we're not communicating well. So we can't just stick with the old language. There's some value in drawing those connections. We need to draw those connections, but we also need to be open to what, you know, from a mainstream Mormon perspective, let's call it ongoing revelation. There's new ways to talk about these things. Science and technology are providing some of those new ways.
Yeah,
to talk
that's
about
a very good
things.
Point. Yeah.
And we should do that. And Mormon transhumanism is about that. You know, I can talk about God, or I can talk about post-humanity, and I'm comfortable doing both, and I would use different words in different ways with different settings and different people, and I think that both are important as we try to engage in this act of reconciliation, in this act of cooperation, in this act of pressing forward in human flourishing. And there you go. You know, I just talked about Christ and atonement in a secular way by saying that.
Awesome. Love it. Hey, you guys, that I think that got at least a flavor beginning there, and obviously people can check out the Mormon Transhumanist website, transfiguration.org, right?
Transfigurism.org,
and I'll certainly link to it here on the blog about this episode.
Thank you.
They can meet you guys. They can come to the conference again on April 6th, or they can get it streamed. Does it cost anything to receive the streaming?
Nope. Free streaming.
Okay, and the conference is a registration, or
yep, the conference is registration. The prices go up as the date gets closer. If you register now, I think the current prices are at $50 per person, and unless you're a student, and then it's cheap. I don't. It's like not even $15, I think, for a student to get in.
Okay, so there are ways to explore a little bit about what you guys are doing. I'm also going to post a pretty major article we did on Sunstone that you two were among the group of authors that did it, and it's on sort of parallels and complements and different things between these, and you get a little more introduction there. And so I'm excited for all these things to be put in front of our listeners. And again, I began the podcast with, here at Mormon Matters, I love it when Mormonism is taken so seriously that, you know, you actually pay attention that there's depth and that there's richness and there's subtlety of thought and there's fresh angles. And I really loved having Lincoln and Chris on as embodiments and fellow travelers and trying to put that forth. And then Tyson, I'm so grateful that you were here to be this voice. None of us want to reduce ourselves to archetypes or something, but you really added a lot today. So thank you for that. Is there anything that you would want to close with, Tyson, just to make sure, to clarify your position vis-a-vis transhumanism or what's going on with the Mormon transhumanists?
Well, it was a surprise to me to learn that there were Mormon transhumans and transhumanists and the whole movement. I was aware of the Singularity conferences and the work of Ray Kurzweil, and it's very persuasive in many respects, and it has a lot, and it embodies a lot of hope for humanity and idealistic principles for our future. I think it's a very encouraging, and would like to have more conversations with individuals who keep their mind open to these ideas and advancing humanistic principles. I think that only good things are going to come as a result of it.
You guys can all become Facebook friends tomorrow.
Absolutely.
Or no. I hope you guys will connect. And Tyson, please come to the blog. And I have a feeling that we could get pretty nerdy in our comments here, or we could stay broad. But let's get technical. Let's get nerdy if we need to, you know. So I'd love to have you be part of the after discussion. So thank you. Lincoln or Chris, anything final left on your plate that you didn't get to say?
No, I think we covered it pretty well. Thanks.
Yeah, I just want to say thank you, Dan, for giving us this opportunity to talk with you about it, and Tyson for engaging us on it. I've enjoyed the conversation.
Great. Thank you very much, guys. I appreciate that. So please, listeners, come to MormonMatters.org and engage us and ask questions and tell us what you think. Donate, please, while you're there. Could really always use some funding. It's becoming a bigger and bigger part of my life and stuff, but I love it. But dollars is always wonderful, too, so it really makes things a lot easier, and it makes my wife a little less stressed. So that's always important to Wetherspoon flourishing, right?
Yeah.
On the happiness front, yes.
You need to have a left, right, and center where people will text to see who won the argument of the day. And my support of the matters.
I love it. Anyway, thanks so much, guys. Hey, good night. And again, I look forward to you guys continuing this conversation a little bit with our listeners on the blog. So thanks for that.
Thanks.
Good night.
Thanks.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening. All is well.
all is well.